As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you something extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. And the best part? You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound, on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. Try Aaron Carnes' In Defense of Ska. Celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's annual report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or click the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS. Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we talk to the drummer Budgie. He's best known for his work with Susie and the Banshees, but before he joined the Banshees, he played on the Slits record Cut. The Slits were one of the best groups of the UK's post-punk era, and they captured all of its best elements: experimental songwriting, a spirit of fun, and with reggae and ska elements mixed in. The record, which was released in 1979, was produced by Dennis Bovell, known for his work with British reggae band Matumbi, Linton Kwesi Johnson. We talked to Budgie this week to understand how he joined this project, his approach to reggae drumming, and to gain any more insight into this iconic album that we can. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis, who played in the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
So growing up, I think both of us listened to a good amount of what at the time was called alternative rock, but also is, I think, more specifically considered like goth music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Susie and the Banshees, specifically the Peep Show album, was huge for me as a kid.
Yeah. I listened to it, but I didn't probably listen to it as much as you. Mm-hmm. You know, I was all about The Cure and Depeche Mode. I liked Susie and the Banshees, but I definitely spun the other ones more. Interestingly enough, I didn't see them live, but I saw with you, I believe, The Creatures, right?
I didn't actually see The Creatures. You must have seen them with another tall ska friend.
Okay. Yeah. I saw The Creatures. That was the other band that Susie and Budgie were in. And it was, I saw them at Petaluma at the Phoenix Theater, and it was a rad show. Super good.
Nice. Yeah. I got to see Susie and the Banshees at the Warfield.
Mm.
When I saw them setting up, they weren't putting any keyboards on stage. And I realized, oh, I'm not going to recognize any of these songs.
They're about to rock out.
They played all their early stuff, which I know now, but wasn't familiar with it then.
So one of the good things about Budgie being a guest on the show is that he is a drummer.
Yeah. We love talking to drummers.
We love talking. Yeah. Ska music, reggae music. You know, it all goes back to the drummer. That's one of the reasons why we like talking to drummers, but also just because drummers are cool.
Yeah. And I'd also like to point out that Budgie has a podcast called Curious Creatures with Lowell Tolhurst of The Cure. And I'd just like to take this moment to formally invite Lowell of The Cure onto this podcast whenever he has a chance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Also Robert Smith.
So much of British post-punk was influenced by ska and reggae. Two-tone ska was only a piece of this story, as we learn talking to Budgie.
Well, first off, you just said you've been doing your due diligence.
I always get that wrong. I can never say it. I do it, but I can't say it. It comes out all wrong, you know? It's really not correct.
No. Is this your ska due diligence? Is that what you've been doing?
My ska due diligence, yes. And it took me back because it takes me really to when I started buying music.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because the stuff I was listening to and at school, that's what I came up to, was Prince Buster and Al Capone's Guns Don't Hug You and Max Romeo's Wet Dream. And it's like, that was like 1969. Al Capone was 1964. And I was getting this in high school, like, so it'd be like early 70s. But Max Romeo, Wet Dream, it was like, I mean, every time I Googled it, you know, everybody from my age said the same thing. So I'm walking around the kitchen going, lie down, girl, let me push it up and push it up. Lie down, girl, let me push it up, push it up, lie down. And like slap round the head from mum, you know, don't let me hear you singing that. What? No, it's just a new song. It's in the charts in Britain. It was amazing.
Was Return of Django by the Upsetters the first record you ever purchased?
That was a tune used on, I think it was, like, I'm going to say Cadbury's Fruit and Nut advert, but I think it wasn't, but it was like, I don't know what it was about that. It was just a great tune, but sounded so different than anything else, you know, in the charts, which was kind of on the cusp of glam rock and my cusp of heavy metal. But at school, I was like, I was sick of getting beaten up by skinheads. So I became one. Because I was growing my hair long and it was just dangerous. So I didn't become a skinhead. I just adopted the hairstyle, you know, the lack of. And I bought, my friends were listening to Tamla Motown, Jimmy Cliff and things, the older guys, the ones with the Lambretta scooters and the job. And I was still in school and I could afford Reggae Chartbusters volumes 1 and 2, which were full of Liquidator, Harry J and the All-Stars and the Upsetters, you know, Lee Scratch Perry and... and then we had some big hits that came in really out of nowhere. What was it called? I Am the Magnificent, 0000.
Oh, yeah.
Dave and Ansel Collins, you know, the things like that. And all these guys were saying later, they'd just been watching Top of the Pops in like Jamaica. And next thing they're in Shepherd's Bush in London. And it's like, there's like Freddie Mercury and there's, you know, whoever was in the studio that day. And they'd never been on the stage, never mind on television. They just happened to be the one that was sent out to promote that song. And I love that way of thinking about music that seemed to permeate everything that was coming out of Jamaica and the Caribbean. It was like, well, what we're doing today, I don't know who's around.
So your skinhead look, what was your skinhead look? Can you remember?
It was everybody did the same thing. We had made our school uniform fit because, you know, we had no money for clothes, but you can get a school uniform together if you talked the right talk. So it was parallel trousers, parallels with braces. You know, you call them braces or suspenders. Suspenders are what you have around your socks, aren't they?
Suspenders are what's
over the shoulder. Okay.
Yeah,
but thin. They got to be thin.
Yeah.
And then the shirt was a Ben Sherman, or it could have been a JTEX because a JTEX was a little bit cheaper. Ben Shermans were like, you know, button down collar, always with a thin stripe. And then to top it was a Barafia blazer, preferably with silver button. And the shoes. The shoes were Comos. The stitched sole. They're really expensive, but if you knew the right shop to go to, you could get your dad to maybe, you know, go that little bit extra from the usual, you know, boys' playground tough shoes that had holes in the toes. So we kind of like, this would be about, I don't know what it is in high school in America, but we've been in high school from 11, 12, 13, about 14, 13, 14, somewhere around there. And, we learned dances. We used to go to each other's houses and learn dances. The guys, it was unheard of. It's like little, you know, those kind of steps like Cliff Richard and the Shadows did, you know, like, and it was, It's like, well, how do you do that? Then you can do this little turn. And then we never did it at the dance, the school dance. We just sat there on the dance floor, like watching the girls going, what do we do if they dance with us? What do we do? I don't know. So we just learned how to boy dance together in somebody's front room. And it's funny, I kept all of those records, and now I have two children now. My little boy's 10, my girl's 12. And they're listening to Snoopy and the Red Baron, and they love Simmer Up, and they love those early Trojan chartbusters, as they were. Because there's a lot of fun in them. And they like the tunes, the really silly tunes, and also things like Desmond Dekker. I mean, just amazing voice. And The Israelites is still probably one of my key tracks to somehow make the world okay, you know?
Yeah.
Dum, 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 dum. It's that kind of... It's so played with such an amazing feel, and yet not overstated. Anybody who tries to play reggae should have to research those, you know, Desmond Dekker and whoever his band is. What was it called? Desmond Dekker and the Aces, something like that.
Sounds right.
Yeah,
I wrote it down somewhere.
you make an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about, because I was reading an interview you did about reggae drumming, and you were saying that, you know, reggae drumming is not as simple as just drop the one, that there's a subtle complexity to being able to play reggae. What is your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I don't know what that subtlety is. It took me ages to figure what they meant by dropping the one. Because you just did it. It's because I suppose it's not really what the drums do. It's the combination of what everybody does. It's why everybody does what they do. So it's not that kind of and on the guitar. They can jank, 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 jank. It's the combination. It's a bit like why I love the guys, UB40, and so did the guys who did Red Red Wine the first time round. But it was somehow a little too cod for me. I don't know why. It was a little bit too much reggae by numbers. And they were good. You know, they knew how to play. And actually, the drummer with UB40 took away the drop in the one and started playing what reggae drummers started to do, was add it back, you know. So it's driving. And put in a boom, 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 back. So it's really dropping the two and three. So it's boom, 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 one, two, three, three. So it's putting that emphasis there, really. And when I sat down, I know that somebody mentioned the Slits album. People mention it a lot.
Yeah.
But I had the most amazing opportunity to sit in, I think it's St. Peter's Square in Chiswick, where Island Records was based.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the port of call for everybody, new guys arriving in London from Jamaica. They'd go straight to Island Records to hook up with either whoever the band they were making the next record with or going on tour with. And the Slits, we were rehearsing in the basement there, and the guys would come down, rolling up, skinning up, getting a bit relaxed, and going, try this beat, you know? And that's the beat that opens cut. If you say about the subtleties of it, it's the playing of that side stick on the rim of the snare, and where the emphasis goes, and then the kick just kind of came and just falls. But what they also, and Dennis Bravell, the producer of that album, who was working with Linton Kwesi Johnson on Forces of Victory, back to back at the same time, we didn't know that, but he was working cut in the day in Surrey at Rich Farm, and he was back in London at night with Linton, And those guys could just amazing musicians. But so what I was going to say was it's dap, 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 dap. That's a slight emphasis on dap, 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 dap. And as I said, Dennis also showed me these, and it was not patterns on the hi-hat, it's just playing the hi-hat in different places. So you're moving across it towards the bell. And so you'd kind of play a lot more with the bell and less on this hammering into it. So it's a lot more delicate. And that's a 5-4, by the way, and we never knew. It took me to get to music college and start to be a professor. And I went, oh, shit. Here's a good example of a 5-4 that I never knew about. That just because it was so natural as a beat.
This is the opening track, Instant Hit, is in 5-4.
1, 2, 3 is the moment. 1, 2, 3. Yeah. And then it shifts to 4-4. Now we're untrained musicians. The girls will be the first to say we were in our first album and it was so hard or so tough to get everything to gel. And we open with a 5-4 going into a 4-4 and back to a 5-4. It's like, huh? And nobody mentioned it. Nobody spoke about time signatures.
It's just all about feel.
All about feel, yeah. And that came from directly from Jamaica to the heart, really. It was quite an experience. And that's the beauty of it, is you find out of those subtleties a bit later when you got to look back at it. You're much too much in the moment and got to get this album done in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
To really consider what else was going on. But thanks for asking the question, because I love going back there. I'm writing a memoir, so a lot of this is quite present and correct in my head at the moment.
I really like how that's a good song to talk about, Instant Hit, but the whole record feels kind of rhythmically disorienting a little bit, which is something I really like about it. Like it has a groove and a vibe, but you kind of like almost just get lost in it, like you, the listener. And it doesn't feel like punk or rock, and you can feel the reggae elements, but it doesn't really feel exactly like the way reggae feels either. It has like it's in a weird its own space.
It could well be Dennis's influence at the controls there. Because he put us through our paces. I had to be rock steady. I'd never had a producer, or I'd not done many sessions at that point. But I knew about rock steady. I knew about giving the equal weight to things, because we were not in the days of, oh, we'll take a bar and sample it. You know, this was playing for the duration. So things like So Tough. I didn't recognize the track when it was cut, because it compressed the drums so much. They sounded like little tin cans. And I was going, oh, what's he done? And it's magic, because it pushed the drums into their own little space and gave a lot of room for the bass. And the bass was Tessa and Ari's design from Heavy Dub. It's the biggest, fattest bass sound. That's what they were going for.
I really like in So Tough, that's the second track. I love how there's this section, I think it's like the bridge maybe, where the bass and the drums start to build, but then it kind of falls back into the chorus. Like it doesn't. Yeah.
And that count either. There was no counting. It was ba-dum, ba-dum, bum, 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 bum. What's that? Am I on the right track? Bum, 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 bum. That's a 5-4 as well. It's very close to the original version of the song, which had Palmolive playing. I think there's that. I'm getting mixed up in my songs. So
But it is interesting how like different the most of the songs sound. If you listen to like the Peel sessions, or I assume when you saw them live, which you'd seen them live before you joined the band, right?
Chaos, total chaos. Yeah, usually ended in a fight on stage.
Really?
Ari and Palmolive would often she'd just turn around and go, "Oh, fuck it, do you stop again, Palmolive?" And Palmolive just like, "What?" And they just kind of confront each other, but like there's no audience there. They're not on stage. And then she'd sit down. She had like Doc Martin boots on, you know, like silver ones. And like she pummeled that kid, but it was her way of playing was just intuitively musical, in her own way. There was no continuous, there was no linear thought. It was like chunks of music that went together. So they just sped up and slowed down, and sped up and slowed down. It was that's the way they sounded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it wasn't until the introduction of it. Of let's try and do four on the floor. Let's try and do it. Imagine a metronome. We didn't use a click track, but that's the bit. That was the big change. And then it all kind of gelled. But the excitement and ferocity of the Slits was, nothing else sounded like they did. Nobody else sounded like that way, which gave everything. Do a runner. Do a runner. Do a runner. Da da da. You know, those elements stayed, but just became regimented.
Yeah, it's like there's all this interesting, weird space and rhythms, but then there's like this sort of energy that's like youthful and fun.
Yeah,
as well. That I think makes that all the weird stuff not seem quite as weird, maybe as it actually is.
I think it was Ariana's birthday every day, you know. She just went in.
That's a good attitude to have.
Yeah, and she was just on fire. And you know, she'd say, "Okay, Tessa, you're going to go and sing this one," because Palmolive had written the lyrics to about Adventures Close to Home, I think. And Tessa didn't want to sing; she'd never sang before. But Ari had played the bass line. Crazy bass line, just all over the neck, but just the ability to just do that. She had it in her head. She boom 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 boom. So it's like, and Dennis is just going, and then she's going, "I'm going to put some piano on there," and it's like jazz piano, and we just go, "What?" So it was precocious. It was amazing to be there for. But that was the way she was, and the way she danced. It was, you know, like kind of praying mantis look, you know, the kind of knees bent, bum out, hands here, and it's like, and scared the life out of everybody on the dance floor. Ah, you know? Oh, fond memories, really, but it's, but really life changing. Quite life-changing. The number of people who come up to me and said, "That album, it just, you know." And I remember meeting Viv quite a few years after. You know, I was certainly with the Banshees at that point. And I said, "So, like, what's it feel like? You know, it's a cult album, isn't it?" And she went, "What is?" I said, "Cut. It's like everybody's talking about it again." I said, "Really?" I think she was a TV producer at Channel 4 at the time, so it was maybe her vision was like slightly somewhere else. I suppose, like with many first albums, it's you know, one of the guys who came up to say what an influence it was Justin, who played drums with Elastica, and you know, I just thought, really, well, you heard that album? It's like, sure. Sure. It kind of went under the radar, but hit a lot of people's awareness. It didn't set the charts alight, you know. It wasn't like radio play, although I think Typical Girls may have got some radio play.
Well, it's weird, so I can understand why maybe it wasn't on the radio, but it's like when you look at this era, this time period, which is like a great era for music, 1979, in the UK. It's still one of the best ones. And I also think it's like one of the best examples of using reggae influences in a way that's not expected and maybe different than you would think reggae influences would be incorporated into music.
Yeah, didn't Led Zeppelin try it?
You know, it's funny. I read an interview. No, it wasn't an interview. It was an article. It was about John Bonham, how much he hated reggae.
I know.
And he said that he was under duress to record that song.
It must have been really hard. I can somehow picture Led Zeppelin arriving at, like, there's a story that of John Bonham and Jimmy Page going down to the Vortex, you know, on Oxford Street, round about that time of 79. And the Damned are playing, you know, or the Damned are in the club, and Rat Scabies is like going, "Back off, Bonham." And Bonham's going like, "I'll come back, mincemeat of him." You know, kind of funny. I somehow imagine John Bonham didn't, you know, had that accent when he was out, but the interviews I've seen with him, he talks ever so correctly. Robert Plant, and he doesn't sound like a Brummie from the Midlands. They're really quite well spoken boys, you know. And so that bad boy image, a bit, you know, was something perhaps they grew into.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
But it is an interesting, I took it with, from Big in Japan, there was a couple of COD things we did, which were not great.
You know, it'd be interesting. We haven't really talked about this on the podcast, and I don't think this is something that people in the US are very familiar with. Can you explain what COD reggae is?
COD.
Or COD, yeah.
COD reggae. I don't know what the term really is. Like, we had a thing at school said like kidding, but it's a bit COD, and it's a bit like pretending.
Okay. Yeah,
trying maybe too hard, so you use the most obvious elements and go, "I got it." And so, like, for instance, you know, oh, dropping the one, it's just like it becomes like a cartoon of the music you're trying to play. So yes, Big in Japan did one called, I think we were actually under the name of Cindy and the Barbie Dolls. It was a blatant attempt to get a record contract with something like KTEL Records, you know, some really awful German sub label. And it was like Bill Drummond and Ian Brody and we had a couple of girl singers, and it was awful, but it's still there. I think it's actually on the EP, Cindy and the Barbie Dolls. And but I took a few things with me from those Liverpool days, and they ended up either helping me through the Slits album, but they certainly cropped up in the Banshees. It was around Kaleidoscope, because that was probably the experimental way into the band. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I remember doing was, once I figured out the drum beat for Happy House, which was all over the place, it started off as a Keith Moon eccentric roll around the kit thing with reverb, until I got that kind of floor tom heavy beat. But the B-side was called Drop Dead, a lovely little song dedicated to the two guys who'd left the band.
Got him.
Drop Dead. Yeah. I'm sure Kenny and John and Kenny love that being, you know. But what I'd done was, I did the drop in the one, but I didn't do it on the hi-hat. I did it on the snare drum, so it became more militaristic. So it's like, rather than, so it's basically a reggae beat applied to a kind of subversive rock track. Mm-hmm. And it taught me a lot just there, just thinking, well, why don't I just do that on the snare drum? Because on Happy House, I'd move the floor tom to where the snare drum should be and put the snare drum over behind the hi-hat. And that beat was born of an accident of trying to hit the snare, get back to the floor tom, and hitting the hi-hats on the way around. So it's boom, boom, to get, boom, boom, to get, boom, boom. And I suddenly realized that drum kits could be anywhere you want them. And depending on where you put, how you position them, different beats will come out of the same movements. And Bill Bruford said it at the end of his career. He said that his kit was totally symmetrical by the end of it. Snare drum in the middle, I think probably two hi-hats, and toms going both out in the same direction. And then he said that wherever I put my hand, I'd hit something that sounded good. Not that he needed to even think that, but I think what it meant for him was like economy and mm-hmm. and getting away from the and all the way through the he's got to plug my computer and all the way through the 70s toms were just getting more and more dead and leaden and just let me plug this in. It was just a good point for perhaps bringing up, perhaps it was because a lot of us, the reason we were there was not because we wanted to be musicians, but because we were fans of music. Mm-hmm. We'd grown up as listeners. And then we picked up instruments kind of late in the day and thought, what do we like? And it could be anything from, you know, Wipeout by the Safaris to The Jungle Book or Lee Scratch Perry. You know, put those three things together and you got bound to get something interesting going on.
This moment in Big in Japan, before this moment as a drummer, because I know you'd played drums for a while. You did some cabaret stuff. You did the Spitfire Boys.
Yeah.
Were you approaching drums in this sort of way before that? Or was this sort of the first moment where you were kind of seeing the potential for how to play drums in an unusual way?
Yeah, it was definitely the experimentation started in Big in Japan because I was daring to bring in some of the influences of, if you like, progressive music. Yes, and ELP, which I buried and hidden. I just mentioned Bill Bruford because he's the maestro and I love the sound of his unbelievable playing. But I could never go anywhere near. I couldn't even emulate anybody like John Bonham or Ian Paice with Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin. Bill Ward, maybe. I could fix some of his things out. And of course, my namesake, you know, Budgie, the Welsh band. I could figure their beats out as well. But what it was just that I... With the Spitfires and anything before that, I'd learned how to play song structures, chorus, verse, bring it up for the chorus, bring it back for the verse, move from the hi-hat to the ride cymbal. Nobody taught me these things. It was just listening. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to the Spitfire Boys, I was the only one who knew how to rehearse. So I just, you know, said, we need to get on with it now. When I got with Big in Japan and then Ian Brody stepped in and Bill was the driving energy force. And then Holly Johnson came in on bass, and Holly wasn't a bass player. It was like making little nuggets of music and how to make them interesting. So, yeah, it would be doing things on the snare, on the kit. And Holly and I would sit around and work out syncopated bass and drum patterns, which we're not going to 1, 2, 3, 4, boom, gap, boom, gap, boom. This was going boom, boom, gap, boom, boom, gap. Gap, gap, bum, bum, dip, gap, bum. And then going into a kind of a heavy chorus. But it was more, well, I realized it was more probably where Wire were going, which I was missing or something. You know, it was after like Pink Flag and the thrash of punk.
Yeah.
That Wire were on a progressive rock label anyway, you know, their own Harvest or something. And I still love listening to Wire because it was the humor in the lyrics and the seriousness in the music. And yet the drummer's called Robert Gotobed. So I think it's anything could happen. And you had license to do that. And really, because the rule book had been kind of thrown out, nobody really would dare to say, that's not the way we do it. And there was a new kind of breed of producers coming along. And that kind of, I suppose, does lead us back to Jamaica and Lee Scratch Perry and the adventurousness and the inventiveness of how to record and use the desk as an instrument. and people like Mike Hedges, and even Nigel Gray, who did the first Police albums. We did Kaleidoscope with Nigel. And there were people who, I think Nigel was like a qualified doctor. So he knew the guys. I think he got himself a studio because he could afford one. And he knew Godley and Cream, I think. And there's a good example of guys who left a successful band, 10cc, to do a duo called Hot Legs and make a crazy little song called Neanderthal Man, you know, in a desperate attempt to get a hit single. But they were influential because I certainly was always listening out for something that was against the grain. So I liked Fleetwood Mac, but I loved Peter Green when he flipped out and got all these African drummers in and did like eight minute long drone things. And they go, it's Peter Green, he's in Fleetwood Mac. We better play it on the radio. And I go, what? You know, I can talk about all this now because it was not allowed in 1979. You couldn't talk about your influences. You didn't know what they were. And if you did, nobody would know. But, you know, it's a bit like Julian Cope coming out with suddenly the knowledge of krautrock and everything that ever happened that way. Mm-hmm. And John Lydon having Can in his closet and Faust and M on Duel 2 and all these amazing names and amazing album sleeves that we just, that was enough for us. You know, the music could wait. Just the names of the bands and the album sleeves they made. We're going like, oh, they're just great. How can we do that? And then we listened to the music and just thought, what is that? What is this crazy stuff?
So I know you weren't in the Slits initially, but were you in the band when they got their deal with Island, or did they get you in after they already got that deal?
I think they've been demoing. They'd certainly worked with Clive Langer and Dick O'Dowd. These were people, and they're getting closer to the focal point, I think. And Island, I think we're ready to I'll forget his name.
Chris Blackwell?
Chris Blackwell was looking for his band, you know, his pop band, and maybe a girl band. There was two interesting elements going on there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think they already had the deal in place because my first port of call was not a rehearsal room trying to get a deal. It was with two producers who were hastily banished, but they were being paid for by somebody trying to get Palmolive wasn't there and the band was being readied for recording. So the first thing we tackled was Typical Girls. And that was with two producers who had worked out of Threshold Studios, Decca Studios in London. And they were great. They were good guys, but they were coming from a different world. And they emphasized that need for the snare drum to stay down the center. And we were shifting in Typical Girls from boom, 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 to a swing from a straight four. But that snare drum had to stay the same. And to me, that was unnatural and then became second nature. But it taught me the need for regularity in dance. I kind of knew it, but not to play, not as a player. And so as producers, they pointed this out, and that weight, consistent weight of sticking, which you again is a sure sign of somebody who's a weekend player. Maybe less so now because there are too many tutorials out there. But at that point, you didn't have any reference points until you got to the studio. And then all your weak points were pointed out to you. And it was too late because you were in the session. So, you know, you know, tuning and stick weight and rattly snares and rattly bass drum pedals. Hi, John Bonham. All will be revealed in digital enhancement, right? The squeaky kick drum pedal. But it's fun. It's kind of it's real. You know, some of the drums recorded back then were not the best sounding kits, but the atmosphere in the studio was working. It's something when you take it out of that context and analyze it and go, holy shit, is that what they put the microphone on that thing? And it wasn't important that day when we got to get this down now because otherwise I'll forget it.
Yeah,
the moment was everything.
It's interesting that you were speculating that Chris Blackwell was looking for a pop band and a girl group. The Slits were not, they were a pretty weird band. I mean, it's strange to think like, that's going to be a pop band or whatever. And then the fact that he ended up landing on Dennis Bovell as the producer, who's like, you know, did dub and reggae.
He just had a big hit. Yeah. Dennis had a big hit with, what's her name? Silly Games. That was a song he wrote, I think. Silly Games with, I can't remember her name, beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it wasn't that he wanted a girl band or a pop band. He thought he could mold the Slits into, I think.
Yeah.
I thought, there's my opportunity to do something.
Yeah, I don't know how moldable they were.
Not at all. he underestimated that challenge.
Yeah.
But he yes, you're right. He pulled in Dennis to, what's her name? K. Something K. And Wicked Games, I think it was called. No, Wicked Games is Laura Del Rey, right? Silly Games. She had a very high falsetto voice in the chorus. It was a bit like Midnight at the Oasis type territory, you know.
Janet Kay?
Is it Janet Kay? Yeah, I think it is.
Silly Games, all right.
And that was a big hit in Britain. So we had like producer with a big hit under his belt. All female band. What could go wrong? Ari could sing probably an octave above what Janet Kay had ventured towards and did.
I heard a story you said about like the first time, I don't think it was the first time you met Ari, but I think the first time you went to her house and she like she showed you her record collection, and it was no punk at all. It was all like R&B and soul, and it was like pop music and well-produced music. And I think she was indicating that like that was the kind of record she wanted to make.
I think without maybe even that consideration of this is the album I want to make, I think it's Viv pointed out in her book, you know, Ari was a teenager. She was 17, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So these were the things she was listening to at school, if she ever got into school. But she was a teenager, and that was the stuff that was on the radio. Grease had just come out. Spirits Having Flown by the Bee Gees, I think, was a big dance record. And she wanted that kind of sound, and she wanted, and it crops up, you know, tell me more, da, da, da. It's a bit of a sassy attitude creeps into her thinking. It's irreverent, so she's taken it to the nth degree. The biggest thing for me was the way she rocked to music. She just rocked this kind of, it was a very physical experience, and I've just been writing about that night myself, and I think about it often because I felt like I met a kindred spirit, you know, that she felt music. She expressed it physically and had the musicality that was hidden somehow. It was waiting to explode.
Yeah.
I don't know if she had an idea, if she knew, because she was so, what's the word, so not in awe of the stage or the audience. She didn't care. They hated it. In fact, it's like, so what? You know, it's like, say, it's not going right. Let's just stop and start again. There was no concept of putting on a show. And yet she was very much the show, a front person. She would tease the audience. not in a sexual way, because it was like that was not something in our formula form in a world. But the teasing, the backcombing of the hair, the knickers over the pants or tights, it was all a confrontation.
She seemed like the kind of person that had a lot to say and a lot of emotions to express, and she had pretty good access to that, which I think that's sort of the artistic struggle, is having access to the thing that's in you that wants out.
Yeah, that's fair assessment. And as I say, the studio became, that's where she got serious. That's where it was really important.
We'll be right back after this.
Can you explain the atmosphere and environment that, I don't know if you would say Denis Bovell created an atmosphere, or how did he kind of sort of conduct the studio sessions?
Wow. Methodically. We worked in, I think I remember an interview with him, but it was, we'd start early in the day, we'd start working on the backing tracks, and there may be a guide vocal, which almost certainly would have been kept if the arrangement was correct. Mm-hmm. And we were really going for bass and drums. And it was a very, it's Rich Farm is was one of the maybe one of the early residential rooms that Roxy Music had used, Bad Company had used it. So everybody had their favorite space. And I remember thinking, oh, well, I'm not going to go well. Paul Thompson sat, or Simon Kirk sat, you know, got my own space. But it was his guidance in the importance of tempo. He wanted to play rock and roll himself. It was quite funny, because once we'd finished work for the day and the girls maybe gone off to eat, he was saying, Patrick, get on the drums. I've got this tune. Down, 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 down. And I go, yeah, okay. That's not reggae. he was an all round musician, Blackbeard. Didn't he play with Mutumbi?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. So I saw those guys. There were so many bands from Birmingham and Bristol, black reggae bands, or Aswad, you know, there was so much live music and so varied. So we still have like the band The Pirates from Johnny Kidd and the Pirates' heyday, you know, playing Walking the Dog, you know, which I remember as like a 6-year-old coming from the park bandstand. So you got that and dub reggae and punk and dance music, all kind of vying for center stage. It's kind of crazy time. So Denis steered us through it, kept a low profile, gave Ariana a lot of space, nurtured Tessa through the bass lines because it was familiar territory. He knew the role of that bass, to be there without being there, you know, just to be there as a solid.
Yeah.
And working with Viv, she describes it so well, because she hadn't been playing guitar that long, but she had a good idea what she didn't want to sound like, and it was really the things that I think she mentions Keith Levine a lot, who really nurtured what he saw as her inventiveness and told her not to be frightened of that, not to try to be like anything else. But it was tough because she was under the microscope of the studio. And with Ariana just kind of going on a limb with every possible, you know, picking up the bass and just being fluid with it, was very, you know. And I'm sitting there like, I'm quite comfortable. I'm still, you know, trying to do things that I haven't done before. But it was. They were really going through it. She was really having to work really hard every day. And then a lot of her parts would be laid down afterwards through trial and error, through take after take after take. But things like So Tough, I remember, we played as a band. FM Newtown. Yeah, we once I got that beat going, it was just like one take.
It definitely feels like your parts and the bass were weird and experimental, but kind of steady.
Yeah, to be. Yeah.
And then Viv's parts on the guitar were unusual and found like totally different territory. Like they weren't the same thing that you guys were playing. She was doing something like she was filling different space. Yeah.
Almost percussion.
Yeah.
More like kind of tune percussion and sound effects. So I just remember there are the like motifs. She had little motifs and she had to place them and make them work.
Yeah.
So that was a tough call. Once we got the groove going, it was just like a plate all day. Boom, 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 boom. That's probably a 7/4. We haven't talked anything about Sky, have we? Not really. I don't know. I know. I did look at the tape. It was just interesting to see that Elvis Costello produced the Specials' first album.
Oh yeah. While we're on the topic, this is interesting because the same year that this record comes out, this is the same year that Two Tone kind of explodes on the scene.
Yeah, I saw that and was like, really? Yeah, I saw that.
And so and then I think you joined Susie and the Banshees the same year as well, right?
Yep, 79. I did like five albums that year.
Yeah, what was your take on Two Tone? I mean, I don't know if you saw it coming or if you kind of saw it when it exploded as well, when Specials released Gangsters that year.
It was interesting because I if you look at like Two Tone, Bad Manners were in there with the beat.
Yeah.
And I like the beat for something entirely different than what I thought Two Tone were about, you know. I love the playing saxophone. Bad Manners was more, there were not quite cod, but there's certainly more pantomime going on. And there was a fine line between, you know, having the zoot suit or the rude boy suit, and not the zoot suit, but there was a fine line between wearing the clothes and just having something genuine. And I think the Specials came closest. I like Selector, but Selector were definitely out in the pop world, and did some really great stuff. To me there was a sense of, because it happened so quickly, it was almost as fast as punk arriving, and everything was quick to jump, much quicker to jump on the bandwagon at that point because it already happened very recently. So that every record label wanted a punk band, everybody wanted a ska band.
Yeah,
you know, the Morris Minors became madness around that time probably. And but you know, as Suggs said, he'd grown up with Al Capone and Prince Buster.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a bit younger than, maybe, I think he's a bit younger than me. But they were such big hits. And so when you got your band and then you say, oh, we can do that, let's do One Step Beyond. Let's do it. Last Boat to Cairo, whatever it was called, you know, Slow Boat to Cairo. But it's there were cover versions were allowed in.
Yeah.
You know, and that stylistic choice was allowed in. But it, you know, it produced some amazing tracks. I think Specials took it somewhere else, really. I always remember seeing Jerry Damazon, and I've looked for it since. I can't find it. But it's like him sitting probably with something like Jules Holland and going, well, this is the way it came from. He mentions Fats Domino, and I loved Ain't That a Shame. When I was growing up, when I was a little boy, I just heard this voice. I loved the voice, and I loved this. It was just embracing. It was just a warm feeling. And Jerry Damas kind of went from that through to more blues through, and I'm going to get the morphology wrong, but it was just, all he was doing the same chord. And then so I'm almost like, I think Ragtime was in there somewhere as well. And then he was just dropping out one part of the rhythm until he arrived at reggae, ska, reggae, or whatever. And it was the simplest explanation of like two decades worth of musical development by just like leaving one finger out of the chord or playing the emphasis slightly different. Yeah, I could imagine, you know, it was difficult for him and the band to rub along harmoniously for longer than they did.
They were definitely not a band of childhood school friends that formed a band. That was very calculated, sort of like piecing together a band to fit a certain vision. And that can be challenging to stay together when things get tough.
One of the high points is, for me anyway, is what the way that they morphed into a kind of mysterious band that produced Ghost Town. You know, just the influences there that they were taking into Fun Boy 3, I suppose.
When you were in the Slits and then Susie and the Banshees, did you feel like that stuff was within the same realm of like post-punk music, or did that feel like something completely different and in its own sort of scene?
Well, we didn't feel like we had a bunch of people doing the same thing as us, but it kind of happened eventually, I suppose, looking from the other way. If I was over in, I don't think they'd be looking, but I suppose bands like Sisters of Mercy and The Mission came along on our coattails a bit, and The Cure, maybe. You know, we got pretty incestuous with The Cure. But so I think we turned from Kaleidoscope, where, yes, anything like could have, that was post-punk primarily, and all of the other things happening all could fit into a similar genre that you couldn't quite identify. There was a lot of things going on Kaleidoscope that didn't make any sense in a genre. But by the time we hit Juju, we had devised a band sound that was very much our sound. Meanwhile, the Police are on the ascending with reggae into rock, which was very, you know, I suppose they did something very smart. I was watching a documentary just yesterday about as Padovani talking about the transition from him being in the Police to not being in the Police. And it was the arrival of Andy Summers getting together with Sting and then Myles Copeland. It was all these influences that came together at the right moment. So a disparate bunch of musicians end up playing rock music with a reggae tinge, you know, and Stuart Copeland just can't stop playing, you know, playing harder than anybody. And yeah, we end up with a producer, and yet we sound up with, you know, he just done Roxanne, and he's going, it was a nightmare to do that out. That song, really? So yeah, because I had to, boom, boom. It was like after the beat. So he's in the control room conducting it. Well, really? Isn't that okay? So it's just, there was so much going on, so much happening around the same time. It's hard to compute it all now.
I think something that doesn't really get discussed a lot, that was a very innovative time for music. And you can look at, you know, what a lot of these bands started, you know, like ska, you know, goth, all these different things sort of stemmed from bands at this time. But I also think that a lot of drummers like you and Stuart Copeland were sort of reinventing how pop bands could play drums in a way. I mean, it was a lot of like experimentation in that realm.
In a way, perhaps it was the construction of the songs that was different. I think if I listen to one of my favorites, there's a lot of people's T-Rex, Electric Warrior. And if I listen to Will Legend, gets mentioned very infrequently, and Nick Cave just done a cover of Cosmic Dancer. And that's the record that made me want to be a drummer, I think.
Mm.
Because it was just, and he does this thing, it's like that, you know, Cosmic Dancer, for instance. I was dancing since I was 12. Boom, get, yeah, boom, get, boom, 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 get, boom, boom, bat, boom, bat, boom, bat, boom. I'd never heard anybody do that. And it stuck. And it was really like collecting these ideas. And I still love that fill. And Ginger Baker did it. Da-bum, da-bum, da-bum. Terry Bozzio does it. You know, and everybody thinks it's like I just found this great thing. But it's amazing how it's just passed around. And of course, then he does these amazing fills at the end, Will Legend. And I never ever hear his name mentioned. So just a shout out for Will Legend on that.
Yeah.
Electric Warrior. But massive influence and other unsung heroes. Perhaps it's the role of drums in the mix as well. And that could well be to do with something like what Dennis was looking at. If you think of Return of Django and that drum fill, which doesn't sound like a drum at all, you know, it's somewhere in the back and it sounds like a little tiny drum kit. And then he kind of emulated that for So Tough, where he just compressed everything out. And then Mike Hedges would compress and have gates and have drums getting bigger as a cymbal swelled and opened a gate. And these tricks of the studio started to become part of the mixing process. With Nigel, I got to do two drum takes side by side, Call and Answer, on a track called Skin at the end of Kaleidoscope. I think we had three tracks left. So I said, can I go and do another take? And everybody else was like, Steve Jones was in the studio and he was like having a party over on that side, and Susie and Severin, everybody was there and nobody was really paying attention. So I just like slid out the side door and went back in and did another take, and they're going, what's going on? What's he doing? He's done the drums. it meant that drums could kind of take a little further, command a bit more attention.
Yeah.
And without resorting to the skills of Billy Cobham, and the Mahavishnu Orchestra, the things that had traditionally been where you heard drums louder and were when they were technically amazing, and there was not much else. Well, I say not much else going on, but it was not so much to do with the lyric and the song. You know, it was to do with, you know, top this, you know. You think you can play? Play this. That was very much not the attitude. It was like, how can we make this exciting and yet fit the song? It was challenging.
Yeah.
But we were young and full of it.
Young and full of it.
You got to take, you know, it's like being John McEnroe, isn't it? In center court at Wimbledon, you've got to go for it.
Yeah.
You don't get that chance very often. Yeah. So magic moments. So we learned from John McEnroe, probably. You can't be serious.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slo Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
All right, Aaron, what is your favorite Susie and the Banshee song?
Oh, are you really going to put me on blast like that? I don't even know the names of their songs. My favorite song is The Night. Let's just say it's The Night. There's probably a song called The Night, right?
You don't even know. I love it. Do we want to start over? Do you want to keep this?
There's no starting over when it comes to outros.
There's only going forward.
I do like Susie and the Banshees, by the way. I just don't know any of the song titles.
Sure.
Yeah. So I just want to put that out there. If you're listening and your name is Susie, Sue.
You could have said Happy House.
Yeah, Happy House.
You could have said The Killing Jar. You could have said Till the Last Beat of My Heart. I think that's the name of the song.
Wow.
Listen, I don't know all the names either, but I do listen to Susie and the Banshees. And you know what you should listen to? You should listen to
The Behind the Curtain.
The Patreon. That's right. Behind the Curtain. Head on over. Sign up for the Patreon if you're not already there. If you're listening to this you're not signed up for the Patreon, because people who listen to the Patreon, it just goes straight to the part of the episode that's after this. But instead, you, the person listening to this for free, mm-hmm. you have to hear this part, which I don't know. There's some value to this too.
Yeah. This is probably worth twice.
Yeah. So, you know, you're already getting a little something. Why not give us a little something? Why not go support, defend Ska?
I believe we talked to Budgie about our own various times of seeing his bands live. And I think we just like geeked out on him.
We just fawned over him.
Yeah. We just said, you're awesome. We love you.
I want more of these post-punk musicians.
Yeah.
Robert Smith. Come be on the show.
Robert Smith. Right now.
Yep.